Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Welcome back, and it is now or never. Sorry about that little bit of a pause. I was just counting the days of the week. Got family visiting and so forth, and, you know, you kind of go, what? How much time do we have? Because, you know, I don't know about you, Sean, but, you know, vacations, family coming is not a vacation. It's much better, but it's not a vacation. And sometimes it can be worse, but it is not a vacation because you're trying to get things done. You got, you know, expectations. I mean, as a matter of fact, how many times have you gone on a vacation where something has happened that really just kind of ruined it? Has this happened to you?
Oh, well, of course.
Okay. All right.
Who hasn't?
Right. So, you know, in some cases, it could be a car rental. Could be the hotel. Because when you kick off your vacation, you have these expectations. Well, with family, you know, it's not about your expectations get completely, you know, dissolved into the collective, because now that you have all your kids and your brothers and sisters, siblings, parents, I mean, in a family reunion, that collective can be pretty big, if you know what I mean. And usually, if you're not running the reunion, if it's a reunion, then, you know, it's, you know, you're just on for the ride. You're just going up there, and you can't have any expectations because somebody else is, you know, making these plans, and we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and you're just kind of along for the ride type of thing. But it's not a vacation. To me, a vacation is where, and my beautiful bride and I, we've gone on vacations where we literally just, you know, walked along the beach. We just did nothing other than being together and experiencing and sharing the time together. And that was pretty much it. And, you know, are you better for it? Well, I guess maybe. I mean, it provides a regeneration. A vacation can provide a regeneration. But I don't know about you, but I've never had a vacation where I felt regenerated. Because usually when I come back, I feel like, boy, I could use a real break, a vacation to rest from my vacation. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so
the last vacation we had was when we evacuated because of a hurricane.
So. So I haven't had, as a matter of fact, there's the irony. I haven't had a vacation since 9/11. My wife and I, we went on a vacation. We got home literally a couple of days before 9/11, I think 2 days. Our daughter connected back with us after our vacation because she graduated from the military, you know, basic training, boot camp, what have you. And so we went there for her graduation. She came back with us. And actually, she was a flight behind us, so she was back the next day. But the following day was 9/11. And going, wow. What I mean, and from that point on, a lot of things had changed. But and it wasn't 9/11 that kept us from having a vacation. So anyway. So sorry about the delay, folks. That debt is fraud. It's now or never. What's it going to take to get you engaged? We're running out of time. And you need to, you know, maybe you need to have these family talks, neighborhood talks. We need to start talking about what the heck we're going to do. And I'm telling you, it's not that hard. Everything points to your local government. These PR campaigns, everything we've been talking about in yesterday's show, there you go. I mean, we're trying to make it easy for you so that you have a resource to go. And we want everybody to know this is a Reclaiming the Republic PR campaign. These people don't deserve to be in office because they're violating their oath. And Section 3 of the 14th Amendment says so. They should not. They're no longer eligible. Maybe that's what we need to put on the sign. Give me some thought, Sean. Maybe that's what we need to put on the sign, is this person is not eligible to be in office anymore. We need to get rid of them because the Constitution demands this. Ask us how. This is how we can start teaching people that we have a right to hold them accountable and that the Constitution has a standard. And that standard was added in the 14th Amendment. So we've got somebody willing, which is Jerry Wistrand, who signed a pledge willing to be held accountable. We want every public servant that wants to put their name on the ballot, one, to be knowledgeable of the Constitution and to be held accountable to supporting it. That's what we want. What would our government be like if everybody wanted to be held accountable and they were bending over backwards? You know what? I kind of made a mistake here. I'll leave it to the voters. Should I step down? Wow. What a refreshing government, and what a refreshing, I'll just say, country and nation and county this would be. When I say nation, I really mean, you know, your state, because your state is an independent and sovereign nation, the country being the United States and counties. So, folks, let's look at it in that perspective of a hybrid constitutional republic, which I kind of highlighted on. And the beautiful thing is, since technically we're about ready to get into the weekend here, I am looking at the fact that let's give the people some meat for the weekend. What do you think, Sean?
Everybody needs some meat on the weekend.
There we go. There we go. So,
especially in the summer.
Yeah. Some extra smoky meat or what have you. So we kind of left off with Mr. Bowdoin, however you pronounce it, and his legislative powers and so forth. There's a paragraph that we didn't cover. So let's go ahead and finish that last paragraph, or actually there's two. But if the advantages of the Confederacy, admitting the principles, that one, because there's the second little paragraph after that talks about of a union of states are not confined to merely safety. But anyway, let's do those last two paragraphs. Then we can keep moving forward, okay?
Roger that. But if the advantages of a Confederacy, admitting the principles of it to be good, are duly considered, that is, will give security and permanency to the several states, not only against internal disputes, but wars with one another. If the wars in Europe arising from jarring and opposing interests are a public calamity, if it is for the benefit of ourselves and future generations to prevent their horrid devastations on this continent, to secure the states against such calamities, it will be necessary to establish a general government to adjust the disputes and to settle the differences between state and state. For without a confederacy, the several states being distinct sovereignties would be in a state of nature with respect to each other, and the law of nature, which is the right of the strongest, would determine the disputes that might arise. To prevent the operation of so unjust a title, to afford protection to the weakest state against the strongest, to secure the rights of all against the encroachments of any of the states, to balance the powers of all the states by each giving up a portion of its sovereignty and thereby better to secure the remainder of it, are amongst the main objects of a confederacy. But the advantages of a union of the states are not confined to mere safety from within or without. They extend not only to the welfare of each state, but even to the interests of each individual of the states.
Okay, so let me ask you this. It may not have been going through your mind, but as you read this, everything that they were talking about, the states and the national government, should have been equally applicable to the county and the state as a general government. Does that make sense?
Correct.
Yes, so, folks, does. So when it basically, when he says to secure the states, let's just say it, to secure the counties against such calamities, it will be necessary to establish a general government to adjust the disputes and to settle differences between county and county. For without a confederacy, the several counties being distinct sovereignties would be in a state of nature with respect to each other. And the law of nature, which is the right of the strongest, would determine the disputes that might arise. What he's talking about right here, and I'm highlighting this as a special note, without a confederation to the end of that might arise, what is he talking about right there? He is talking about mob rule and population centers literally arising and becoming the strongest. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because if you look back at the history that these men were privy to of what was going on in Europe and that factional constant warring for thousands of years before that, from the Roman Empire on to our era, I mean, that's exactly what was going on. You had these states that were fighting against each other, and whichever one became stronger, for whatever reason, they would try to overtake the other. And they didn't want that set up here on this continent to be the same as it was in Europe.
Right. So I'm hoping that, you know, when we look at what's going on, because the idea of allowing one population center to bully, strong arm, and dictate abortion and dictate all sorts of unseemingly, you know, corrupt things upon the state, taking away your liberties, taking away your rights, like in Illinois, your right to bear arms. All of these types of things, folks, that is what happens. And it's the state government. This is why this should not be happening in a state. This is why this concept of republics and a hybrid constitutional republic is so applicable. This, you know, you hear me say this, and I'm not saying this because, aha, I got it, because it took me a while to get it. And I've had the luxury of not being engaged in anything other than prayer and study, doing this work for, over 10 years now. Because I can tell you I've grown immensely in understanding the Constitution in the past 10 years, just because I've been able to challenge. And I've gone out there and challenged other people. And sometimes I've had, I've been fed a little bit of crow, if you know what I mean. Because I wasn't right. And if you know me, you know I love being right. And so when I have to eat crow, that's the last time I'm going to eat crow from that flock, or whatever you call the groups of crow. I think there's a gaggle or whatever you call them. I don't know. Forgive me for not knowing, because it's important. Because there is a particular name for a bunch of crows. But anywho, my point is that this is the awakening, folks. We have the opportunity. And as a matter of fact, I want to point out that this is an inalienable right. I can't emphasize that enough. This concept of this inalienable right that we the people have to institute our government. That when government is faltering us at our county level, I'm telling you, your county government's faltering you because it's not doing your wishes. Because you never did your job in setting it up. And now the state government is using it as a puppet to do whatever they want to. And the state government has become a puppet for the population center. This is why, when we start looking at why are all the states, these big states with large populations, why are they struggling? It's because of the people. It's because of the mobs and the mob rule. California is way out of control. And who would argue that? Texas is getting that way. Texas is on its way to getting that way. So I've mentioned this before, Sean. What would be a good idea for Texas to consider? Any ideas?
Well, I know they have a big problem with their Muslim infestation. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but that's what's going on. They're circumventing everything they can to try and build these power centers, kind of like they did in Minnesota.
Yeah, so I would actually venture to say that Texas is primed to set the example to divide itself into multiple states. And in so doing, if they did that, because you could have the Gulf Coast state, You could have, you know, the central, you know, the Dallas-Fort Worth. You could have the far west, and then you could have the southern tip where San Antonio could be left by itself, or, you know, that southern tip area. But my point is that if they broke themselves into, if one state, like Texas, broke itself into four states, that would change dramatically the Electoral College. The representation side wouldn't change too much, but you would now have, instead of two senators, you'd have four, or eight, I'm sorry, you'd have, because if you had four states out of Texas, you'd have now eight. That would grow six electoral colleges, where now these new Texas states would, or the breakup of Texas, would actually, and most of the people, those are going to be still red states. There may be one blue state, which would be the southern tip. And I'd rather see the southern tip, the southern tip struggle on, you know, on their bad designs and so forth, and let them go into, you know, financial, what do you want to call it, conservatorship, to where, you know, we step in and say, look, you know, we're not bailing you out. You're going to have to pay these debts. You're going to have to stop spending money on things you can't afford. We have to, you know, do you do your children a favor by bailing them out every time? No. As a matter of fact, the only way, you know, you have the only way eagles become eagles is they have to soar. They have to get out there and they have to soar themselves. If you feed an eagle and you constantly, you know, mother it or what have you, you don't allow it to, you know, do what eagles are innate to do, to soar, then you've basically killed a breed. You've got this big chicken. You've domesticated an eagle that's designed to soar. So my point is that we have this inalienable right. And this comes right out of the Declaration of Independence, folks. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever the form of government becomes destructive, that whenever any form, I should say, of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is a right. So I'm gonna highlight this for you folks, because he lists these inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I believe that this following, when he says, it is the right of the people, in other words, this is an inalienable right to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government. I believe that that string, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it should go life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and our right to alter or abolish our government and to institute a new government. Those are inalienable, because most people, when I tell them this is a right, God gave us this right to institute these governments. And if they're not serving us, we have the right to dismantle it, alter it, change it, institute anew. This means that even though you may not have, and they've already staked claim to your county, because I think that from what I said yesterday, some people have it up here in the back of their head going, yeah, but we really don't have this right to do that. Excuse me? Now that we're heading in towards the time when we actually read the Declaration of Independence, folks, you now have an advantage going into the 4th of July. You now actually hear me telling you that we have this inalienable right to alter, abolish, or institute a new government whenever it is becoming destructive. It's taking our property. It's ruining our lives. It's our quality of life is getting worse when they're not abiding by the Constitution. And technically, folks, every state government is trampling. And when I say trampling, I'm talking about with horses, elephants, and all kinds of livestock, pigs, trampling on your state constitution. Because I've yet to find a state constitution where the people have delegated to that state government the power to regulate their labor and establish a minimum wage the way that they're doing it. They don't have that power. They're doing that. And 9 times out of 10, they don't even have any power delegated in the state constitution to regulate the quality of your housing and the building structures and so forth. All of these things have, because of the corruption starting at top, they just made it and they did it to all of us because we were none the wiser. But the beautiful thing is, while we still have this opportunity before it is stolen from us by the globalists, we have the time right now to do this, folks, before this next financial crisis, before they decide to pull the trigger, and before Congress once again, specifically the Senate, decides to unconstitutionally pass a treaty surrendering our rights to this Constitution, is basically saying we're no longer going to abide by the U.S. Constitution because we can't afford it anymore. We're literally bankrupt. And they dissolve the United States. They don't have the authority to do that, but they're going to do it. They're going to convince us that they have the authority to do it, and they did it. What's going to stop them is your state legislature has to stand up and say, hold on, time out with the big T. You know, everybody doing the big T moment here. Time out. Where in the Constitution do you have the authority to do that? This is our call. We're not dismantling you. And as a matter of fact, what we're doing is we're going to hold you accountable. We're reeling you in, and we're going to feed you to the wolves because you put us in this position. They can get their pound of flesh out of you, because you never had the authority to do all of these things. That changes everything, folks. I hope you understand this. It changes everything. That's why I say that debt is fraud. This is the only show at all that is repeating this over and over and giving you the facts. And I hope that this is sinking in. I'm not asking for your money. I'm not asking for praise. I'm asking for you to do your job as a citizen to support and defend that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, specifically the domestic ones. These people in office, they're the enemy because they're doing things they have no authority to do. So anyway, I guess I went on a little tangent. Forgive me, but I thought it was important to kind of tie all of this together. Forgive me, Sean.
No problem, sir.
All right. So now there's this little note that comes out from Samuel Adams. Now, this is after John Hancock. Just remember a few days ago, you read what John Hancock said, that he wanted to see this Constitution get ratified. Now we have Samuel Adams come to the table or stand up and basically say this. Now, we've got barely a minute left, and there's a lot more here than that. And we have some of this stuff highlighted, but this is definitely worthy of reading and hearing. And, folks, there's a lot of people that use Samuel Adams' name in saying Samuel Adams did not want to go to the Constitutional Convention. Samuel Adams did not favor, you know, he supported the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation. He did not support the U.S. Constitution. I've actually heard people say that he deliberately, you know, did not want to have anything to do with the Constitution, and they get away with saying that when actually we have proof right here that Samuel Adams was, you know, was apprehensive about the Constitution until John Hancock said what he said. And then we actually go through this, and you can see how he goes, I see the merit here. And guess what? We not only point out that he sees the merit, we show you how he votes, because at the very end of this, this is one of the few ratification debates that GR adds a little bit of analysis to show you how this Constitution was ratified out of the state of Massachusetts. So anyway, there we go. We're literally going to be going into break. I apologize for, you know, an extended diatribe, but sometimes you just have these hard breaks, and we've got to get through this one. That way, I can wet my whistle and sustain longer diatribes, because I'm almost at my point. Anywho, folks, we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so with much anticipation and bated breath, we now can listen and hear the Honorable Mr. Adams.
As Your Excellency was pleased yesterday to offer for the consideration of this convention, certain propositions intended to accompany the ratification of the Constitution before us. I did myself the honor to bring them forward by a regular motion, not only from the respect due to Your Excellency, but from a clear conviction in my own mind that they would tend to affect the salutary and important purposes which you had in view. Quote, the removing the fears and quieting the apprehensions of many of the good people of the Commonwealth, and the more effectually guarding against an undue administration of the federal government, end quote. I beg leave, sir, more particularly to consider those propositions and in a very few words to express my own opinion that they must have a strong tendency to ease the minds of gentlemen who wish for the immediate operation of some essential parts of the proposed Constitution, as well as the most speedy and effectual means of obtaining alterations in some other parts of it, which they are solicitous should be made. I will not repeat the reasons I offered when the motion was made, which convinced me that the measure now under consideration will have a more speedy as well as a more certain influence in effecting the purpose last mentioned than the measure proposed in the Constitution before us. Your Excellency's first proposition is, quote, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated to Congress are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised. This appears to my mind to be a summary of a Bill of Rights, which gentlemen are anxious to obtain. It removes a doubt which many have entertained respecting the matter and gives assurance that if any law made by the federal government shall be extended beyond the power granted by the proposed Constitution and inconsistent with the Constitution of this state, it will be an error and adjudged by the courts of law to be void. It is consonant with the second article in the present Confederation that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States and Congress assembled. I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers the strongest guard against the encroachments of power, and I hope the people of this country will always be thus watchful. Another of Your Excellency's propositions is calculated to quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen lest Congress should exercise an unreasonable control over the state legislatures with regard to the time, place, and manner of holding elections, which by the fourth section of the first article are to be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, subject to the control of Congress. I have had my fears lest this control should infringe the freedom of elections, which ought ever to be held sacred. Gentlemen who have objected to this controlling power in Congress have expressed their wishes that it had been restricted to such states as may neglect or refuse that power vested in them, and to be exercised by them if they please. Your Excellency proposes in substance the same restriction which, I should think cannot but meet their full approbation. The power to be given in Congress, to be given to Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises has alarmed the minds of some gentlemen. They tell you, sir, that the exercise of the power of lay and collect direct taxes might greatly distress the several states and render them incapable of raising monies for the payment of their respective state debts or for any purpose. They say the imposts and excise may be made adequate to the public emergencies in the time of peace, and ask why the lay and direct taxes may not be confined to a time of war. You are pleased to propose to us that it be a recommendation that, quote, Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arising from the imposts and excise shall be insufficient for the public exigencies, end quote. The prospect of approaching war might necessarily create an expense beyond the production of imposts and excise. How then would the government have the necessary means of providing for the public defense? Must they not have the recourse to other resources besides imposts and excise? The people, while they watch for their own safety, must and will have a just confidence in a legislature of their own election. The approach of war is seldom, if ever, without observation. It is generally observed by the people at large, and I believe no legislature of a free country would venture a measure which should directly touch the purses of the people under a mere pretense, or unless they could show to the people's satisfaction that there had been, in fact, a real public exigency to justify it. Times sure have changed. Your Excellency's next proposition is to introduce the indictment of a grand jury before any person shall be tried for any crime by which he may incur infamous punishment or loss of life. And it is followed by another which recommends a trial by jury in civil actions between citizens of different states, if either of the parties shall request it. These and several others which I have mentioned are so evidently beneficial as to need no comment of mine. And they are all, in every particular, of so general a nature and so equally interesting to every state that I cannot but persuade myself to think they would all readily join with us in the measure proposed by Your Excellency if we should now adopt it. Gentlemen may make additional propositions if they think fit. It is presumed that we shall exercise candor towards each other, and that whilst on the one hand gentlemen will cheerfully agree to any proposition intended to promote a general union, which may not be inconsistent with their own mature judgment, others will avoid the making such as may be needless or tend to embarrass the mind of the people of this commonwealth and our sister states, and thereby not only frustrate Your Excellency's wise intention, but endanger the loss of that degree of reputation which, I flatter myself, this commonwealth has justly sustained.
Okay, so there's a few things that are really worth pointing out. And so the first thing, in the very beginning, he basically points out that he, after hearing and after thinking a little bit more about it when John Hancock was saying what he was saying as the suggestion, and then he goes into the second thing, he kind of helps everybody understand this is what he says. I did myself the honor to bring them forward by a regular motion. In other words, he made the suggestion and he moved that they be done. Not only from the respect due to Your Excellency, but from a clear conviction in my own mind that they would tend to effect the salutary and important purposes which you had in view. So in other words, he's basically saying, folks, that he believed that this Constitution needed to be ratified, that he wanted to move this forward so that it could get ratified, and that we could start seeking these amendments by already coming up with these types of amendments that he gave us. As you can see, you know, in the green area, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated to Congress are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised. Another point that I want to bring up is just a little bit below that. It says, if any law made by the federal government shall be extended beyond the power granted by the proposed Constitution and inconsistent with the Constitution of this state, it would be an error and adjudged by the courts of law to be void. The one problem he has is that the courts do not possess that power, and he should be thankful that they don't. The courts don't have a negative power. The only way the laws can become void is, and this is why I go back to, how important is it that our courts be representative of the states? If they be representative of the states, then I think that the court should have the power to be able to declare. Does that make sense? In other words, declare that this law is void, giving them negative powers over congressional laws, over legislative laws in your courts, or I should say in your states. Does that, folks, this should actually make sense, because you don't want a bunch of, help me out here, you don't want a small mind model like we have today in SCOTUS and in the federal court system, the Ivy League paradigm of the progressive ideology, because this is why you see the problems with our court system. It is not representative of the states. As a matter of fact, it is antithetical to state sovereignty. This is why they make their rulings and they do what they do and they create laws and so forth. But, and this is why I go on and on, that they don't have these powers. I'm okay with the court having negative powers if it's a representative court. In other words, if you have a justice that is appointed from each of the states, and let the states determine whether they want to have an Ivy League Supreme Court justice or whether they want to have, you know, a Supreme Court justice that has graduated from the University of Wyoming, from their own university that understands what's going on in Wyoming and Wyoming's legal justice system, Wyoming's needs, and so forth. Because, folks, again, our state justice system has been run the federal government has ran ruckshod over our justice systems by basically wiping them out and forming them the way the federal government wanted us to behave. They didn't have that authority. How are we going to restore that? Well, first off, we need to make sure that the courts will never reach in and do that again, because if we have a representative Supreme Court, then they will never allow the justice systems of each of the different states to be changed ever again. You can go back to how you implemented a trial by jury in your state by common law and how you were implementing common law. As long as, again, we got to go back to you know, some of these things, because each of the states needed to change their common law when they gave up their theocracy to model towards the Constitution instead of the Bible. Now, does a state want to have common law based on the Bible? Can a state use common law based on the Bible? That's a question. Can it?
I would think so.
Yes, because if the people want it, and so... The only way to do it would not be by declaring it by the state, though. This goes back, folks, to how do you really secure your rights? By not granting those types of powers to the general government. In other words, each county would then determine for themselves where, you know, do they want a common law, as long, because you got to remember, the common law has to be subordinate to the U.S. Constitution. So, in other words, you may have a Bible, and you may, you know, have a biblically based common law justice system, but it cannot be in conflict with the U.S. Constitution and your state constitution, which is why if you make your state constitution a general government and very limited, it makes this very easy peasy. The bottom line is you can get there, but to make everything so that you don't have these conflicts, so that everybody understands. You know, the whole design was to allow us to have these petri dishes, to have all of these differences and so forth. That states didn't have to be so uniform that even the state judiciary would be modeled, like the federal judiciary, to conform to the differences of the counties, allowing counties, again, to be these petri dishes. Anyway, folks, the only reason that we're capable of doing this is because of that Constitution, because of the U.S. Constitution, because the divine hand of providence made it so constrained and so confined as an exemplar that why didn't we do that to the state so that we could actually have these liberties and our self-determination down at the county level? Well, we can. We have just failed to do it. Again, my fingers are pointing. Nine times out of ten, when you point your finger, you kind of ball a fist, and you got one finger. I learned a long time ago from my dad, because he's pointed out, every time you point your finger, you know you got three pointing right back at you, right? And I said, oh, okay. So that's what I just started, you know, like in the Marine Corps, when they start pointing at people, they have the whole hand pointed out at you. Every finger, even the thumb, is pointing at you. You need to. So that's how I point now. Anywho, let me go on. I think that there might be one more little thing that I want to point out, and it's a little bit up because he starts talking about this amendment to the Constitution, that Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arise from the impost and excise shall not be sufficient to pay the public exigencies. This is another short-sightedness by Samuel Adams. The first one was allowing the judges to just void laws. No. We got to have a representative government before that happens. And in this particular case, we also don't want this to become the case. Folks, don't rush into saying we want a balanced budget amendment. We want this type of an amendment, because this gives the federal government the ability to spend money on things that they shouldn't be spending money on. I think the amendment should literally say that no expenditure can, there can be no penny spent by the federal government on any object that is not within the enumerated objects within this Constitution. In other words, the refugee program. Well, they don't have the authority to do that. They can't spend a penny on doing it. They can't spend a penny on, welfare to come in and, help states with, natural disasters. I don't think the federal government should be doing that. I believe that the states should be doing that. I believe that when one state, suffers from a hurricane or from a storm, a bunch of tornadoes, the best thing for it is for the other states to come and rush to its aid. It's the siblings. You don't want to create the child to come down and basically say, I'm going to take care of you. That's the child government. And when you give them that power, they start abusing it. This is where the counties first would be the first thing. The parents of that state would basically, the counties would come together and say, we need to help. We need to start pulling together. So it starts with the counties, and then it goes to the other states. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so,
because then you would get rid of a lot of this ridiculous bureaucracy that, like most charity organizations that you have today, they become so massive that most of the money that people donate trying to actually help the fellow man ends up going in the pockets of bureaucrats who are living off of other people's suffering, and the people who need the money and need the resources never actually get it,
right?
Because it has to go through this monstrosity before it gets there.
Excellent point. And so if you want to have a welfare state, it has to start at the county first, and you have to basically say, we're going to have, if you want to call it a rainy day fund, I would say you don't make it money. What you need to do is you need to be able to have, food. You need to have fuel. You need to have the basic things that you absolutely need, because money becomes absolutely worthless when you're starving. I don't know how much nutrients are in gold. Most people claim that it's got everything, but I would say no. When you're really starving, you need grain, you need tomatoes and meat. Let's get back to that meat. You need some steak.
Empty that freezer.
But that's my point. I remember, when I was young, up in Washington State, they have this thing called the Grange. And the Grange is in every county, and this is where the farmers would pull together, and they would, you know, save beef. They would, you know, for the ranchers would save some of their beef, and they could let that beef go as a, you know, as a charitable contribution or what have you. But back in those days, refrigeration was so expensive that the community would get this huge freezer, you know, like a locker, and you'd have every, you know, and we actually had a locker in the Grange freezer because having a big freezer back in those days was just too expensive and too hard, and your house only had limited electricity and so forth back in, you know, as before we started building homes in the 60s, right? The older homes weren't designed for those types of appliances. So the point is, folks, is that that's how it used to be. That's how it was. And we got away from that. That's where the churches and the communities and the people pulled together. And we actually were able to sustain ourselves. We didn't need FEMA. We didn't need people spending the trillions of dollars. The only reason it costs so much today is because government is involved. Remember, it was Milton Friedman that wisely said, if you gave the federal government the authority to regulate and control the Sahara Desert, within 5 years it would run out of sand.
For sure.
So, okay, so Mr. Mason, I'm sorry, with an N, anti-federalist, let's see what his comment is that I wanted to highlight here. Let's go ahead.
When, sir, we dissolved the political bands which connected us with Great Britain, we were in a state of nature. We then formed and adopted the Confederation, which must be considered as a sacred instrument. This confederates us under one head as sovereign and independent states. Now, sir, if we give Congress power to dissolve that confederation, to what can we trust? If a nation consent thus to treat their most solemn compacts, who will ever trust them? Let us, sir, begin with this Constitution and see what it is. And first, quote, we the people of the United States do, etc. If this, sir, does not go to an annihilation of the state governments and to a perfect consolidation of the whole Union, I do not know what does. What shall we consent to this? Can 10, 20, or 100 persons in this state who have taken the oath of allegiance to it dispense with this oath? Gentlemen may talk as they please of dispensing in certain cases with oaths, but, sir, with me they are sacred things. We are under oath. We have sworn that Massachusetts is a sovereign and independent state. How then can we vote for this Constitution that destroys that sovereignty?
That very last part, I could start with that right here. Because let me go with, but sir, with me, these are sacred things. We are under oath. We have sworn that Massachusetts is a sovereign and independent state. How then can we vote for this Constitution that destroys its sovereignty? So here's the real question. And I'm highlighting this because, folks, the oath is a sacred thing. This is a legally binding thing. And he's saying that how are we not violating this legal requirement of protecting the state sovereignty? Here is where he's wrong. Does the U.S. Constitution take away the state sovereignty of Massachusetts? No. It only takes... So what does the Articles of Confederation offer them? If the Articles of Confederation offered them the ability to tax, the ability to regulate the trade with foreign nations, because it does. It just doesn't have any controls, and it can't enforce it. There's no way of enforcing the Articles of Confederation. We've already covered this, that by granting that they have exclusive treaty rights, actually the Articles of Confederation kind of say that they do as well, but they... The other states, or I should say most of these big states, were already making their own trades. So when we get into some of the other states, you're actually going to see these other states come forward honestly and say, we violate that part of the Articles of Confederation already because we're making our own trade agreements when we're not supposed to. So what's the difference? The difference is that this time they've changed minute parts of the Articles of Confederation into the Constitution, granting the federal government to enforce those powers. So that now, so who cares? The problem was that the states were really running their own cabals. They were running their own, basically, advantages against the smaller states. So bottom line, the state is still sovereign. That wasn't changing their sovereignty. He's making it seem like they were. No, they're actually only giving and empowering this new constitution empowers the general government to enforce those powers that they wanted it to have in the first place. The only real change that probably that nobody wanted to even talk about it, because it's the elephant in the room, and I don't remember anywhere where they said, hey, you know, I don't like the fact that you got rid of the unanimity. Because I think everybody was honest enough to recognize that requiring all states to agree with an amendment was their deathbed. That's why they couldn't do anything. So I don't think there's any anti-federalist in the ratification base that dared even say that. They may have said it in the anti-federalist newspaper articles because, you know, they were just slinging around their own thoughts back and forth, one paper to the next paper to the next paper. It wasn't like a live debate where you had to taste those words walking back from the podium or from the lectern after saying it, and everybody looking at you, did you really just say that? So anyway, the other point that's worth pointing out is he says, now, sir, if we give Congress the power to dissolve that confederation, to what can we trust? Where in this Constitution did they give Congress the power to dissolve the Confederation? It's not in there. He's basically making it seem like Congress has this authority. How is this new Constitution and this new general government to be formed? By the ratification of the states. In other words, the states have to basically say, we agree with this, and it only takes 9. He's conflating these points, if that helps, when you kind of really look at what he's saying. Because people listen to this and they don't know how to pick this apart. Well, I do. So anyway, let's go down to Mr. Nason again with his next comment. Well, hold on here. We only have a minute. And any points you have on Mr. Nason, anti-federalists? I think that, you know, that's why I don't mind having some of the anti-federalists here and in Virginia, because when you really dissect what they're saying, they're making assertions that do not jive with what's really happening. And, you know, everybody thinks, oh, yeah, that he's right on that. Well, okay, when they talk about the dissolving of the militia and how it would be done, the fact is, and when we get to that, when George Mason starts talking about that, I'll prove to you that every point that he's talking about are direct violations. It means that the federal government isn't actually equipping and training. The federal government isn't, because they're supposed to. The Constitution requires that they do that. So if they violate the Constitution, then yeah, we will get away from the militia thing. And that's how we got away from the militia thing. They violated it. It's not because the Constitution made it possible. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
There we go, folks. So that's why we're here. We're here to help you with stating the obvious and proving that, you know, anybody that says the anti-federalists were right, they need to really re-examine, you know, why they say that, because I think they're just echoing a stupid person who said that a long, long time ago. And they've just been basically regurgitating, you know, these bad assertions and inaccuracies. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.